always record episode 135 with Dennis Cook, Alex Fulton, and S.J. Anderson.
Obviously, the time continuum has been disrupted, creating this new temporal event sequence resulting in this alternate reality.
English, Doc.
Here. Let me illustrate. Imagine that this line represents time. Here's the present, 1985, the future, and the past. Prior to this point in time, somewhere in the past, the timeline skewed into this tangent, creating an alternate 1985. Alternate to you, me, and Einstein, but reality for everyone else.
Oh, man, I don't know. There's like a billion things. I was just reading more for the last 10 minutes. I was going through more of Sean Fella's material and... Mm-hmm. Holy crap. I mean, I know that the criticism has been out there that the subliminal bears in the movie photo, movie images and stuff is one of his more extreme material, but there are some in his newest ones that I find extremely convincing, particularly the hallway of that movie Triangles.
Yeah. That movie, I haven't watched it, but seems like it's straight up. Like, exactly The Shining, basically.
Yeah. I really want to get a hold of that. I wonder if it's... I haven't checked YouTube yet or anything, but maybe.
Yeah, I'm sure it's up there.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying reading it. He will be very happy to hear that, because he's taken lots of criticism for that. And, you know.
But, you know, I feel that the more I see those, and perhaps I know that maybe I am a prime target for seeing something that I want to see. I don't know. But, like, the more I see that, the more I'm starting to really connect to what he's attempting to explain. So.
Yeah. And for me, like, I think I told you this before, it's not just the subliminal ones, but the overt bears in Kubrick are enough to convince me that there's something to that.
Absolutely.
Keith.
Yeah.
I told him that I would be on here maybe on the Sync Book talking about his stuff, and he was like really excited. He was like, really curious to hear how I talk about it. He finds it very difficult to talk about his own material.
Oh yeah. Well, I know it's I can relate, but every time I open my mouth, it's a garble of words. But the other thing that I was just looking at that I thought was really good was the the connection between the writer of 2010, I mean, this is a very literal example, but I hadn't read this anywhere else, but that they share the same birthday.
Same day. A lot of people do, it seems, actually. Like, Carl Jung has the same birthday. There's a bunch of others I can't think of at the moment.
I was actually just looking this up before. I only got to that first page of the site, and I went to the Wikipedia for both the dates of the 26th of June and the 6th. And the one that jumps out the most is Paul Thomas Anderson.
Uh-huh.
Was born 42 years after Stanley Kubrick.
I've got a whole long document about Paul Thomas Anderson's connections to this, because he might be Kubrick's literally his prodigal son in some ways. Like,
wow.
Somehow.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm glad that
you're together
nailing that.
What was that?
Oh, I'm glad the two of you are unwinding that. Yeah.
Well, I think
I had known that he was on set with Eyes Wide Shut. You probably know this, Alex, much more than me, but didn't they actually have some contact in real life?
Yeah, well, he was
Paul Thomas.
He was invited onto the Eyes Wide Shut set by Tom Cruise, and the story goes that Kubrick didn't. He was annoyed. He was like, "What's this guy doing here?" Until he realized that he had not only directed Boogie Nights but wrote it. So he was both a writer and a director, and at that point Kubrick like warmed up to him and started being real chummy. And that's really all that's really Paul Thomas Anderson has said about their interaction. But it's an interesting one.
How did he know Tom Cruise?
Because Magnolia. He was in the process of making Magnolia, and I think he had cast Tom Cruise. I don't really know exactly, but
Magnolia, duh, yeah.
Maybe there's some.
Well, one thing about, real quick about Paul Thomas Anderson, I've noticed, you know, his films have gotten more, I think, Kubrickian as he's aged.
Mm-hmm.
And just in the sense of kind of the difficult narrative, maybe, and like slow shots and kind of weird, hard to follow plots. But also in the sense that they're all, based on novels. And that was kind of a hallmark of Kubrick's, strategy. People talk about that was his like mechanism to overlay his secrets, was you just always grab a novel as a way to sort of deflect any of the other things he may have been encoding.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just find that curious about P.T. Anderson, if how much he may have be trying to emulate Kubrick, even in the like, you know, the genesis of his stories.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But,
well, it's funny. One of the things that I kind of, I don't know, it's total sync thing, but it's kind of like David Plates making movie little like overlays of different films playing at the same time. But Sean Fellows made I'll just call him Sean, has made a practice of watching multiple movies at once. Not overlaid with sound, like just like aligned them together and like listened at the dialogue at different parts and looking for correspondences. And one of the experiments I did was watching The Shining and Boogie Nights at the same time.
Wow.
And ooh, it's kind of amazing. There, I think Boogie Nights is basically the same movie. they're like, which is, that's sort of what it comes out of reading so much of Sean's stuff, is that like, it's, all movies seem to be on the same page in some way. Like, there seems to be, like some more than others, but there seems to be this common like harmonic throughout movies that you can find it anywhere, like, and there's a lot of weird stuff in The Shining, like, or in Boogie Nights, because just as an example, in the very beginning, we learn Mark Wahlberg's character's name is Eddie, and Eddie is from Torrance, California. Of course, Danny in The Shining is Danny Torrance, and Jack Torrance is his dad. So, and then Jack Horner is the Burt Reynolds character, so it's Eddie talking to Jack, saying, "I'm from Torrance," and Eddie and Danny kind of sound the same, and they're even dressed very similarly throughout the movie, with the same kind of haircut, kind of weird bowl cut, and it goes on from there. And it was pretty mind blowing when I did that. Shining.
Is Eddie the
what's that?
The porn star. He's Mark Wahlberg's character.
Yeah, Eddie.
Is Mark Wahlberg's character, Eddie.
Yeah, and then he changes his name to Dirk Diggler. That's the name. But
okay, that's right.
His real name is Eddie. Eddie.
Yeah, that sounds like an awesome experiment. That's great.
It's, yeah. Just weird things like there's a shot in the beginning where it's in Mark Wahlberg's bedroom at his mom's house, and he's got lots of posters on the wall, and it's very much the color red. And it does this like panning 360 shot through all of the posters in his red Corvette. And the way it's timed with The Shining is exactly when the first shot of the elevator spilling blood. So like as the blood is spilling, you get all this red on the walls of Danny's apartment, or of Eddie's apartment, or room. And just very strange little connection. I'm trying to think of more at the moment, but by the end of it, like, I forgot the best one. This is the best one, and then I'll stop. I don't know if you remember the scene in Boogie Nights, the first time Mark Wahlberg has sex on film with Julianne Moore, and she, like, they're doing this wooden dialogue, and he takes his pants off, and she looks down at him and very dryly says, "This is a giant cock." Well, at that exact instant in The Shining, she says, "This is a giant cock," and then immediately we see Danny lift his finger up into the screen, and he starts talking to Tony. He says, this is a giant cock, and then bloop. It's like, what? How does that even happen?
Wow.
Yeah, that was the part that I liked the most. But yeah, but that kind of thing happens, and it's weird.
Man.
But interesting. Yeah, I also tried watching The Master with 2001 Space Odyssey. It was an interesting experience. I don't know. It was a while ago, so I can't really remember the details. All I remember is at the end, most strongly remember is at the end, when the Stargate sequence is beginning and the lights just start streaming by, is a shot when Joaquin Phoenix is in the theater, watching Casper the Ghost. And he like stands up and there's this shot of him just like looking at this, like he's kind of front lit, just like staring into the camera agape as the Stargate like opens. And it's the movie screen that he's looking at. And of course the monolith is supposed to be the movie screen opening up. So it's like incredible connections. And not just in the movies, but in their lives. So, I don't know.
SJ, we might have a little bit of crackling from your side there, but,
it might be me, I don't know.
Yeah, I could, I'm hearing that too.
Okay, I don't mean to blame you.
It could whirl.
No, it's fine. Should we try to, just grow with it and then?
I think it'll sort itself out. SJ, there's a couple of things I'd love to bring up, but I want you to have the time to flop it out, so that we can all raise our fingers and talk.
Go ahead. I mean, I'm ready. I can go off on a couple of things whenever, but
yeah,
I'm not,
go
you
for
know.
It. Go for it. Oh, I was. Yeah, okay. Geez, I also listened to. I don't know how I haven't gotten to this yet, but I was going through some of Rabbi Brooke Goldberg's lectures off of your suggestion, and I was curious to what in that particular one on evil that made you think of relationships with color. But also, if that's not where you want to start, let's go to what, or I don't know, go for it.
Yeah, well, I can definitely launch all into that. I just wanted, I kind of had a, just a question, or I wanted to hear a little bit more maybe about some of the stuff we're, this guy's site, Sean Fella. I mean, we can certainly return to that, but this might be a good time to just, I would, ask a question I had about it.
Please do. Yeah, let's keep rolling with Sean's work, cause that's, I mean, it's remarkable.
I'm just, you know, I haven't gotten into it, very deeply. I've got some connection issues and one computer, the flash wasn't updated, but I mean, my understanding, I'm just curious as to what you guys think is his, like, is there a conclusion beyond sort of the mystery of these connections? Does he have a theory about maybe who Kubrick was or if he was some kind of magician or, you know, does he take it beyond sort of the beautiful connection that is clearly exists in the film, if that makes any sense at all. I'm just curious where he might go with that.
That makes perfect sense, and yeah, he does. And that's the hard part about talking about this, because I think it's a pretty wild conclusion. Well, if you look at the front page of his that he has list up there, it says decryptography, a new synchronicity, Stanley Kubrick, occult Hollywood, numeral labyrinthics, and time travel.
Yeah.
So, that's kind of a hint in a way. And, there's on part five, he starts talking about Doctor Who and a time traveler's matrix is what he says. So that's kind of where he heads toward. It's not as like, it's so hard to talk about because there's so much, like context and, the stuff that's been up for a while now about Kubrick, movies and the whole so-called Kubrick matrix that he created, he kind of compares it to a maze, like the maze in The Shining, that Kubrick's films are the maze. And, like, you get lost in it, and,
You know, let's pick that back up because I think I want to hear more about what Sean's saying as the finality of that, but of the, or the, how this time travel, because it's crazy. I mean, obviously this subject is like everywhere around us lately. Like,
yes, that's the thing. Video, that's like, what I wanted to talk to.
Joe's video. I mean, these are outstanding pieces, and like, I mean, you can almost see the consciousness of somebody as a distributed wave here, fragmented in all of these different locations, and it's as you compress that you're seeing the it's in its entirety, which is what I thought Jake Kotsa's video really, I mean, it's really like prima facie type evidence towards that as an idea, but to use a Joseph Farrell word, but one time I was having a conversation with the writer David S. Goyer, because I know I've said this in a couple places, but I befriended him in a weird sort of circumstances, and he ended up buying some of my artwork, and then his wife and my wife are friends, and I've been to his house a couple times, and I asked him about the Sandy Hook being on the map in the Batman movie. Yeah. But that's an aside.
What did he say?
He said, actually, it was very interesting because he was not aware of it. And he wasn't evasive, but he just, it was like information that he wasn't aware of. And then later in an email, he, suggested he made a reference to, of the props people as being potentially like, offer a detail that maybe came up from a prop person or something, which is very curious given that Aleister Crowley's grandson, what, Nathan Crowley, was the prop guy. So again, you know, ghosts speaking through ghosts here. Yeah.
Speaking through who?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's sort of the Sean's Kubrick thing, is that it seems in some ways that, like, have you ever seen the movie Being John Malkovich?
I know that really well, yeah.
One of the interesting little date intervals has with Being John Malkovich is that I think it basically, Being John Malkovich was released 237 days after Kubrick died.
99. I saw it in the theater in 99 there. That was right the same year that Eyes Wide Shut came out as well, I guess. Yeah.
So there's like, first of all, there's that weird little temporal resonance, like 237 days after Kubrick died, this movie Being John Malkovich comes out. And what is Being John Malkovich about is about, which I had forgotten until I watched it again recently, that it's about this group of people who are essentially time travelers. They are using human vessels to prolong their lifespans, and then Malkovich is the next one in this that movie. And so it's like, and then the metaphor of puppeteering of puppeteers, and so it builds into this like kind of notion of like who's holding these strings, like who is the puppeteer behind all of this kind of weird synchronicity, like, because it gets to the point where it can't, for me anyway, synchronicity, it's just saying, it's almost like we just say it, call it a coincidence, like it's so strange, and so it just can't be random in a way, like there are certain things that just happen that you just feel like can't be random. And it feels like there's an intentionality behind it. And what it all kind of comes down to, again, which is something he says on his front page, is that it leads to an entirely different view of history itself, which gets into, like, maybe history isn't what we think it is. You know, like, we think of it as a linear natural progression from one point to another point, when we don't know that at all. I mean, there's a strange sort of element to history where it's like it feels as though it's been arranged for us in some way, or is being constantly rearranged as we are
absolutely
reading about it.
Sort of, and that's, there's plenty of movies that can be talked about in terms of the idea of it being arranged. But I want to get back to your Labyrinth reference, because at which I think has bearing to what you just said in terms of like the path being rearranged forward and backward, which is sort of the visual of a labyrinth. But this conversation I was having with David Goyer, we were discussing his film or his miniseries called Da Vinci's Demons. And, I was talking about, Sandy Hook, but he was like, oh, then you, and we were talking about, the Sybil came up in terms of the prophetic, information that the Sybil was telling people in ancient Rome. And he was like, oh, you're going to love my new show, that's coming up, Da Vinci's Demons, because it's, at one aspect of it includes this cult of Mithra, which is sort of shadowy behind the life of Leonardo da Vinci arranging his path, or in communication with him in a dream world that gives him information about this. But, you know, I mean, the story of Mithra being the Minotaur at the center of the labyrinth, I believe, is the mythological thing. You know, which your reference to Kubrick being a sort of at the center of this maze was straight Mithra.
Again, it's these resonances. It's the same story over and over again. And interestingly, I've been looking at Infinite Jest again, and which is it. Blows my mind because it's all there too. It's in that book. What is the story? Does SJ, do you know this book, Infinite Jest, the novel?
I mean, I know a little bit about it. I know that it's in a rehab. There's some tennis, and then there's a whole terrorist plot. But I've never read it.
Yeah,
I've read one of his books, "The This Is Water." I guess he made some kind of speech.
Yeah, yeah.
That was you know kind of folksy, but yeah.
Yeah.
I just saw the trailer too. Who's that actor who was portraying him?
Oh, Jason Segel. Yeah, Jason.
He kind of looked just kind of plastic, old,
cheesy. Yeah, sort of typical Hollywood machinery. Even though it's not really. I mean, it's an independent film, but it's still hokey. Well, basically, the plot, one of the plots in Infinite Jest, has to do with, as it happens, a filmmaker, an avant-garde experimental filmmaker who has a reputation for being cold and emotionless and calculating. And he has a son named Hal.
Yeah.
What happens to this filmmaker is that he commits suicide allegedly by sticking his head in a microwave oven, especially very specially rigged microwave oven. And as the novel goes on, it becomes apparent that this guy, this director, has become a like fourth dimensional wraith that is influencing the plot and rearranging objects in the novels for the characters and making things happen like outside of the narrative. And it comes, and maybe he's the narrator inside people's the characters' heads. Speak like using their thoughts, like it gets very weird. And but that's it. Like that's kind of what the idea is with Sean's thing.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. And
and that's the Time Lord idea. Like, and it never occurred to me to think of Infinite Jest as a story about time travel, but in a sense it is, because that's what the character. And of course, and I should have said that this director is the. His final film is the movie called Infinite Jest, which is this movie that is so compelling that the viewer ceases to be able to do anything but watch it. And there's also all this stuff about like these intelligence agencies are after his work, or interested in his work because of its weaponization potentials, and that he might be using holography in his imagery and mise-en-scene to like influence the viewer, which is exactly what Sean writes about Kubrick, and like his whole like Kubrick Matrix being like a sort of hologram, like fractal thing.
See, that's what I think was so, I mean, that I couldn't agree more, because that is exactly what this, that's the type of vision that, that you become acquainted with when you watch a film like, Jake Kotza's Time God. You're seeing in that holographic sense rather than, and, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's not unheard of to me to imagine training yourself and then, traverse. But as you were speaking, it made me think about, the Borg in the upcoming Star Trek movie, and how, so a race having a sort of established network that they are a part of, unifying, consciousness together, a hive mind, and then the only race that ever defeated or easily got away from the Borg, I was reading about this, is this species 8472. They were also called the Fluridians, and they existed in a sort of water state.
Interesting. I just real quick, 84 is twice 42. So
I knew you would immediately pick up the number element. So that's why I wanted to throw that out there. Okay. All right.
You also have 42 and 78 in 84, 72, 78 is the number of the Turo, cards, and 42 obviously is there again.
Yep.
Just an 8472 if you rearrange them.
Wow. Yeah.
Exactly. That's really interesting.
But in like, you know, the numbers dropped in that Jake Kotza video in terms of things popping up in Star Trek seemed really prevalent. Like the original starship had 42 decks. Like, mm-hmm. Come on.
Star Trek is heavy, is a big time. Thing.
Well, I wanted to throw up a point here. I'm on his first page right now. That's the only page I've been able to load, like I said. And this,
yeah, the flash this, thing got me too.
Yeah.
I know.
It's pretty intense.
But
David Plait was having.
This idea of a cult Hollywood. And you mentioned David Plait. This is something that's just fascinated me because I don't know if you guys have heard David mentioning this on Always Record a few times. It's come up, and he talks about so-called adepts that were on the set of the first Star Wars, I guess, like helping the cinematographer and aligning things up perfectly,
adepts
of some kind. Yeah, and I've Googled it. I haven't found a reference to it. I'm really curious to see what David, where he sourced that, or to find out more information on it. But he claimed, apparently, there's this idea that there were adepts as a part of the production that assisted in sort of, I guess, aligning the energy or making it some kind of, you know, tapping it into some kind of energy that would then maybe, you know, propel it out, make it stronger in the minds of the masses or whatever.
Well, that's what I just find, SJ, because the Star Trek people supposedly use channelers to do very similar things. And then if you look at books like Walter Bosley talking about the orientation of Walt Disneyland or Disneyland, I mean, please continue.
Yeah. I mean, but just like you find, I'm wondering, my theory, and this is just a working theory, is that, you know, these guys are in some kind of club and they're tapped maybe, or, and this is of course a loose theory. I'm not patting this as truth in any way, but I mean, you have a Kubrick, Paul Thomas Anderson connection when he's quite young and something exchanged. If you read about Kubrick's life, I mean, Steven Spielberg had a direct line to Kubrick. And they talked on the phone quite regularly. You know, you can go to the Kubrick's work, and I'm not an expert on this, but all kinds of occult connections in all of his films. But Zemeckis is apparently in that crew. I mean, he was friends with
J.J. Abrams too. Huge connections with Spielberg. Yeah.
J.J. Abrams.
There's this club of, some kind, but going to Joe Alexander's work, this might be, I'm curious, you know, is this part of this code maybe? And not to say that they knew 9/11 would happen, but are they able to somehow get this resonance going with their films that it just reverberates in this way? You know what I'm saying?
Well, that reminds me of Frank Zappa's quote about making yourself a motor that was brought up by Wally in his Fine Just Fine episode, because that's, and you know, my friend Kurt Hardesty talks about this a lot. You can move your body in a way in which you can establish a certain type of resonance, and your physical energy can be altered, and that a lot of his physical practices are around creating that sort of thing. So
it also ties to Peter Lavenda, who in his book he writes about Hollywood, and he talks about specifically method acting and just how acting is a form of possession. But it's not just acting, it's directing and writing, and it's all sort of channeling. Like, David Foster Wallace talked about this all the time, that like he would, you know, he goes in and start writing, and suddenly he's like, he hears a voice that sounds suspiciously like his own, but somewhat different. And this stuff just comes out. And what interests me about him writing Infinite Jest is that it just seemed to spill out. Like, he wrote, if you look at you can see the images of his handwritten manuscript of this tiny little script, and it's just, I just don't know where he got this idea, this plot. Oh, actually, I kind of do, because it's Hamlet, because that's what the book is playing on. Infinite Jest is the line from Hamlet, and Hamlet is the death of the father who comes back as the ghost to alter the present. So it's the same sort of thing. But let me throw a little bit of date temporal interval at you to blow your mind, because in between, David Foster Wallace was born on February 21st, 1962. Also, curiously, on the same day as Chuck Palahniuk, the writer who did Fight Club.
Yeah.
Both were born on the same day. 6,666 days later, The Shining came out.
Man.
And
whoa.
If you divide that interval and you go 3,333 days after his birth and before The Shining, you come on the date that a movie called Summer of 42 was released, which is in The Shining. They're watching it in The Shining. And this movie came out 3,333 days before The Shining was released. And in, as Jay Kotze points out in his recent video, in that movie, Summer of 42, there's another movie called Now Voyager, which came out in 1942 that the kids go see. So it's this weird movie within a movie within a movie within a movie, all connected in this like harmonic numerological temporal way that's just spooky. And there's just no explanation beyond what the wildest thing you can think of.
Wow. That's insane.
Yeah. And it just goes on. There's a lot of stuff like that. I forget what I was talking about when I first, well, it was Peter Lavenda and Possession. And I was going to say directing same way, because I made a couple of short films with a friend of mine years ago, long before I was even into like conspiracy, let alone synchronicity. We were just like screwing around. We made a couple of movies, and it's in those movies, like this movie that we made, it's all about the monolith, like without even realizing it. Like it's just, where did that come? Where did all those ideas come from? I don't know. It just seems to be, it's just in the air. I don't know.
Something about Peter Lavenda. I've been really wanting to mention this for a while now. I've read two of the three Sinister Forces books, and in there he describes at the beginning, he says that these synchronicities that come up, he has this whole theory about synchronicity, and he says that when you see like Charles Manson sinks coming up in all these weird places, that it's evidence of what he calls sinister forces.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of his thesis.
Yeah.
Is that it's like there's these sinister forces and you can't really pin them down, but they speak through synchronicity. And, you know, I thought that was interesting. I don't necessarily subscribe to that theory per se, but it's a question I've held in my mind ever since, you know, I've been studying synchronicity and been involved in this is, you know, I think synchronicity is something that's just like part of the lattice work of reality. You find it everywhere, good events, bad events, you know, doesn't matter. You're going to find it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, maybe there's this, a language that is spoken with synchronicity, and it maybe, you know, can expose like these sinister forces or whatever. I'm open to that idea, but I certainly don't think it's all or nothing. I mean, I think it's the sync is kind of an overlaid mechanism of all of reality, but it's just an interesting question is, you know, what is synchronicity? It's kind of a fundamental, you know, and what is it communicating? I guess it's a better question.
Yeah.
And like you guys heard, I know Dennis, this is something I want to talk to you about too, because you did the presentation with, I can't think of his name now, the guy in Manitoba, the Canadian. Mark. Yeah, Mark LeClaire.
Mark LeClaire.
And it was, I listened to it. I wasn't able to, I was on the call, then I got booted from that call, but I listened to it.
Yeah, sorry. I mean, it was never talked about, but I feel really bad because I didn't have any time to prepare for that because I was writing the time of making a bunch of work for a show. And in hindsight, I feel like I kind of let Mark down a little bit that night. And also, like, I mean, I don't know. It was surprising because the members' hangouts I feel like that one was just more intense. I wish I would have done a better job to held up my share in that night, but yeah.
Was that the night that Mark, did he just go on and on for a long time? And
well, no. I mean, yeah, but.
Well, of course,
I mean,
he did.
Yeah, yes, Mark talked a lot, but that had nothing to do with it. I mean, there had never been any other hosts from any other podcast show up, and that night there was like a ton of them were there. So it like the whole thing felt like more serious and, you know, than the mood of some of the other hangouts, like, cause it'd been pretty low key, but like, you know, everybody was, I think we were still figuring out how the hangouts go. And like now they're extremely smooth and like very loose I take credit as ruining the guest presenter, motif that those original ones, which SJ gave a great presentation. So, but I digress. So let's talk about what you're going to ask SJ. Sorry.
Well, that's fine. No, this is kind of a nice transition to some other stuff, but I think that Mark LeClaire, and I thought I was surprised because I was thinking, is he going to take over? I've just listened to all his records and know how loquacious he is and just sort of, I mean, it's entertaining, but I listened to it and was so, it was surprised. I thought he did a great job of just, of giving the presentation and letting other people speak. But anyhow, I'm digressing as well. The thing is that he talked about 17 as being the wallpaper. There's, and that basically we're in some kind of 17 prison where you have this wallpaper. It's like a Truman Show. And so it's like we're in Truman Show and the wallpaper is this pattern related to the number 17. And I just thought that just blew my mind.
Well,
particularly 17. Because the presentation. Go ahead.
Go ahead. You finish.
Okay. I was just going to say the presentation I gave before that, he was speaking to that presentation and I wish I could have been there, but.
Oh, cause yeah, you got.
It was about the star card and different aspects of the star card.
Oh, can you say
that? Yeah, and so, you know, but anyhow, I wanted to talk about that with you, Dennis, but it relates to this question we were just speaking on of what is synchronicity? Yeah, I was just saying, I was wanting to talk to you about that and just, but in relation to this question we were just talking about of like, what is synchronicity? What is it evidence for? The idea of like an occult Hollywood or some kind of what you were mentioning, Alex, someone who is kind of a time traveler that's sort of outside of material world that's maybe kind of going in and out of the material world in a way,
yeah.
Like being John Malkovich, like this director you just mentioned in Infinite Jest. I think there could be some kind of relationship there.
Hey, SJ, did you say that there is a relationship to the number 17 in the star card? What did you say? You cut out in that one part, so I just wanted to get a clarification about that.
Sure, yeah. I would just mention it. Yeah, the star card is number 17 in the tarot.
Okay.
So that's pretty much as direct a relationship. That's the direct relationship there. and wow. The star card. Yeah, I mean, you can look at it
that
in one sense.
That fucking blows me out. That's crazy. I didn't know that.
That's kind of crazy because the star card has been really big in mine and my girlfriend's life just recently. She's done, like, a bunch of tarot readings because we're making a big life change with our living situation, and she kept getting the star card repeatedly. Even today, she got the star card again. So that's just crazy that you brought it up. I didn't realize it was number 17 because 17 is in Kubrick. He repeatedly references heaven 17. This idea.
That's a big thing in that thing is there's a lot about heaven 17.
I don't know if he mentioned it, but that 17 is important in Sean's work because the number 17, the first 17 digits 1 through 17 add up to the number 153, which is one of the cornerstone numbers in his work, and it's obviously in the Bible. So that's another, I just wanted to mention that 17 is linked to 153.
You know, I don't know if anybody's ever talked about or brought this up. But to speak to what you're saying there about the number 17, SJ, like in 2012 or 2011, Pope Ratzinger came out and he was the Pope, but it was somebody else within the Vatican framework came out and said that like they needed to readjust the time in which Jesus was born by 3 to 4 years. And like in the conspiracy realm, Richard Hoagland picked up on this and he was like, oh, so maybe 2012 is actually 2016, 2017 period, which, I don't know, gets you to that 17 number, which, I mean, other people, I mean, that's out there in the conspiracy world. There's a lot of chatter about 2016 and 2017. So, but,
the other weird idea I heard was that that 9/11 was a big ritual to delay the 2012 Congress or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't. I
heard that as well too. Yeah.
I mean, I think that, I don't know. I just, there's always going to be another day. Like it was just recently, there was September 23rd, which still was weird. Like that whole period we went through was significant. Obviously it didn't end the world, but there seems to always be another date to look forward to.
Yeah.
But I'm still looking forward to what happens in 2017. I think it's very possible that.
I don't want to not be here. I love being alive. I'm not interested in, or whatever. I don't know. But I'm not fatalistic about this in terms of anything.
So. Take its time.
Yeah. Alex, do you have anything more to add on 17? Because, I mean, I feel like you could answer that better than me.
Just when I think 17, again, I think 153. And this harmonic, it's a number that comes up a lot. I don't know if I have anything specific that I can think of. It's interesting. Well, just like Paul Thomas Anderson, maybe I'll try to pepper a conversation with these little things instead of laying on everybody at once. But, the movie Full Metal Jacket, came out on P.T. Anderson's 17th birthday. So that's kind of an interesting little thing.
That's great.
I don't know if anything comes up again.
And SJ, what, I do remember that Mark was speaking with a certain amount of direction towards something that he saw in your blog, but I don't quite recall that. I don't know. I'm sorry. I wish I could remember that better.
Well, I remember. I mean, I had written one little piece for my presentation, and it had to do with the star card relationship to the emperor card, and it was all about LeBron James. That was sort of the window into that synchronicity. But at the beginning of the post, I had just sort of my breakdown of how I think about sync in a very logical way, as sort of an equation. I mean, it's all stuff we already all know, but I just sort of broke it out. And part of my conclusion was that synchronicity to me is a mystery. And I actually quote Peter Lavinda and his idea that it's sinister forces, evidence of sinister forces. I talk about, you know, this notion that synchronicity means we're all connected. That was sort of like, I think, an Alan Green quote. And then my addition was just, I think it's a mystery, and it's one of those things, that, a definition of a mystery. I think this may be from the Bible somewhere, but the closer you get to the mystery, the closer you learn. The more you know about it, the more you know you can never know. And so I just thought it's sort of this mystery, and I just kicked it into this idea of mystery. And Mark LeClair said he didn't think that I, you know, really went for the jugular, which I appreciated. You know, I want someone to go for the jugular. I don't feel like I had the ability to, you know.
Yeah.
I just sort of outlined that and then went through the connections. And my definition was connection, synchronicity equals connections plus meaning. And the meaning is the part that's subjective and sort of gets murky because it's very personal, and it's hard to take that leap from the connection, which is objective most of the time, to now what does this mean?
Yeah.
You know, it often, there's no evidence, and it can be difficult.
Yeah, and I appreciate how you apply that to Sean's work, as to ask Alex go straight for the jugular on Sean's work. But the thing about your presentation, just to throw do a quick aside on what you said, is I really liked how you were discussing some of the LeBron James stuff, because the colors of the Cleveland Cavaliers is this sort of burgundy red and yellow and a sort of canary gold or yellow. That color combination comes up a lot. And I think I mentioned this to both of you in an email, but it really reminded me of how, a monarch butterfly has the same sort of color patterns. And as it flutters its wings, it creates a melding of those two colors, which is sort of this green haze that color makes bugs, other predator bugs, sick. It causes a sort of visual disturbance to them that keeps them away from eating the monarch butterfly. So I don't know, the color wise I really liked what you're bringing at, and also, you know, obviously the King James Bible, which is a lot of like esoteric connections. Like, I don't know, there was a lot there.
Yeah, and I mean, this is this idea of an occult, let me see what he says on his site again, occult Hollywood, that there's maybe some kind of group, and I'm not saying like the Illuminati or anything. I mean, I'm just really throwing out maybe a group of adepts or something that maybe are working with this knowledge and sort of interfacing in our reality. Yeah, I think it's fascinating. Like monarch, again, that resonates with the idea of royalty, and it's all throughout the LeBron sinks. So this notion of royalty. But this might be a good time to transition that this color thing and the Rabbi Goldberg stuff, because it sort of speaks to this.
What you were thinking about there. But also, I mean, just as an aside, for a future conversation, we should have my friend Talitha Wall on, because seriously, she had a lot of direct contact with really strange upper echelon folks in LA, like more so than me. And some of her stories are just remarkable. And, I don't know, she's a remarkable person. So like for a future conversation, I know Alex briefly talked with my friend Talitha before. So like, or I guess that wasn't that brief, but we had a chat, but her life is insane. Like, I don't know.
I'd like to hear more about that, her stories.
Yeah. I'd love to talk to her. That sounds amazing. One thing, Dennis, I remember you said you were at an exhibit with Tom Hanks where they reenacted the moon landing.
Yeah, that was
that accurate?
I was in a performance.
Yeah, you sent me a link to the, or I looked it up.
Okay.
At some point.
Yeah, I was in a reenactment of the lunar landing by the artwork was created by this artist named Tom Sachs, who has also since then done a Mission to Mars video in I think it might have been at Gagosian, New York, but it also may have been a museum in New York, I forget. But he built a to scale model of the lunar lander, and then one evening I worked at this gallery, one evening they were like, oh, can you wait a little bit longer? Somebody's coming to check out the thing, and we want you to walk them through it. And it was Tom Hanks and with his son, and they like climbed up into it and like were looking at it or were playing around in it
with his other son, not the one that's an actor. I don't think that this son's an actor, but and then whatever. I could get into some other stuff, but yeah,
such a nutty.
Yeah,
Tom Hanks bought Catherine Kennedy and Frank Marshall, the director producers, you know, that I used to install artwork in their homes occasionally for this other group, and they had a huge collection of WPA art, which is from the artist worker program of the after the Depression. But anyways, I've installed in their house before, and they sold their house to Tom Hanks, which is really interesting because it's also in this really interesting part of Brentwood, which is right by the Getty Museum. And, it's not far from where I've installed art at, Jim Carrey's house, which is right by there. But yeah.
It's just so you mentioned Getty. J. Paul Getty died on the 6th of June as well. I looked that up earlier, the guy who that's named after.
Yeah, Balthazar Getty, and there's a Talitha Getty, but yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
He's the founder of the oil company where all the money came from, J. Paul.
Yeah. Well, that's the Getty Museum is in the Star Trek movie, but Talitha and I did a remote viewing exercise in the Getty based on some information we had heard about there being a ton of levels below the Getty Museum and it being this sort of vault there's a crazy guy that talks about how there's like it's a huge base and that those underground spaces connect to homes in the Brentwood area right next to there. Talitha she's an amazing remote viewer, and she said there was many, many floors. There was remote viewers employed below to get people to try to not look down there, and there was also an area that she could not see in, and she's only experienced that several times, one of which had to do with the Magic Castle in Hollywood, which has got a whole history, but she was like, there's a room in the Magic Castle she can't see into, and she couldn't figure out why she couldn't see in there, but I don't know.
Wow.
But the Getty, yeah, I don't know.
That's interesting.
Man.
Well,
it's heavy duty.
It reminds me that I just read another writer I like is Thomas Pynchon, and I just read his recent novel Bleeding Edge, which is about 9/11. And there's a whole scene. It takes a lot, which is, again, this is weird because I started reading this book after I had been talking with Sean about all this time travel stuff. And I hadn't even started it yet. And I opened up the book to, well, a page. It's a significant page, actually, number-wise. But and there's just this long speech about time travel and how time travel is real. And I wasn't expecting it. Anyway, the whole plot takes off of the alleged Montauk project, and it takes place. The protagonist, this private detective, goes to the home on Montauk of this like tech billionaire, and she's snooping around, and she kind of finds like a weird door that she gets through, and she finds is basically the entrance to a deep underground base with many levels, etc., just like that, and it's people talk about there being tunnels underneath and like leading to various places, and like so yeah, that's not an unheard of concept.
I shouldn't probably share this, but Talitha knew somebody who in his house had an elevator that only had a down button, and she always. And he was a top level financial advisor, and he's on CNN occasionally. And he's as like a financial advisor, but I don't know.
Wow. Getting the
well, it reminds me.
You have the willies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the howling phantoms, if they're possible, something.
Yeah.
What were you saying, SJ? Sorry.
I was just saying, being John Malkovich, it reminds me of that scene, The Door, you know, and he goes into kind of a tunnel and that secret door and that half floor. It's really hilarious.
Well, another thing, this idea, about time travel, and this is in the Montauk mythos, is that whoever, CIA, whatever, use children to do this, like, because they somehow, their minds are more malleable to that thing or whatever, which I just kind of put it together, though, with being John Malkovich with the half-size floor, which is would be a floor for where the only children would be made to go, and that's where, like, the time machine is, so-called, which is the little tunnel that they go in.
Wow, I never thought about that. That's a good point.
That just hit me.
Well, Minority Report, this is just hitting me. The two twins that were in Minority Report that were the seers, that were, like, in all white in the water. They were submerged in that water. You guys remember those two guys?
Yes, absolutely.
There are three. There's one, the two, and then there was another one.
That one actress that's...
Is she in Being John? No.
She's in that movie Code 36 or whatever. I don't know. I'm not blanking.
Cynic Dosh New York is the director of Being John Malkovich's writer's first movie that he directed.
Yep.
And she stars in that.
Yep.
Those two kids, they are poets now, and they both went to the Michener Center for Writers here right in Austin, which is like the second most preeminent MFA program, second to Iowa City, Dennis, right here down the street from me. And those guys, you know, there are these big poets. There was this Atlantic Monthly Journal on them. I met one of them. I used to live in Portland, and he worked at the Whole Foods right there in the Pearl. I used to get pizza from him. But he's got a whole story about Allen Ginsberg. Like, when Allen Ginsberg was on one of his readings late in life, one of these poets, like, went and kissed him. That was in the paper. Like, he went after the reading to his house and kissed him. So he sort of was given the passing of the torch, as it were. But the whole NAMBLA side of Ginsberg is just kind of, anyhow, I'm just kicked into this whole thing about kids and maybe using kids as some sort of, a generator, or not generator, but just a power, kind of a source, or, you know, for their purity, sort of goes into a whole another topic. But that's awesome, man. Creepy, really creepy. There's a whole, I'm getting the willies now.
It's
a very mid.
So what was that? What was? Anyhow.
This is appropriate that we're talking about spooky stuff because
Halloween.
That's also something that Sean has said to me, that he doesn't like talking about a lot of this stuff because it's scary. Like, it seems serious in a way that's like not just, you know, the typical Jake Kotze, like, let's all hold hands and what Alan Green said. He said something like, "Oh, 42! Exclamation point above my head." It's like there is something more sinister to it, I think. Especially in Hollywood.
I do too.
Yeah,
I do too.
Well, the Kubrick quote about Hollywood was that he lived there for a period of time, and he was like, "It has a malignancy hanging above it."
I haven't heard that. I believe it. Where did he say that?
Man, don't ever ask me where things come from. No, I don't know.
Don't worry about it.
I wish I knew. Though, I don't remember. I don't remember.
Well, he moved out of there pretty quick and isolated himself in a big, huge, sprawling mansion. So, in England.
Yeah.
So, kind of.
I'm sure. I gotta say, I gotta get better about writing things down or figuring out. Because I don't know. I'm wrong on a few things. Okay, frequently.
No, that's not a big deal.
Perhaps so. I don't know. Thomas Pynchon wrote Gravity's Rainbow too. That came up. Douglas Bowles was reading that and they mentioned it. And I haven't read any of his material.
Pynchon?
Well, Inherent Vice.
Yeah, Pynchon. No.
Yep.
The Paul Thomas Anderson connection, that was Inherent Vice, was a Pynchon novel.
Yeah.
And I've always had a...
He was a recluse?
Yeah, he's a...
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, Pynchon, I mean, no one... There's, like, some pictures around the internet, but I mean, he's also a recluse, and it just makes me wonder of, like... I think some of these figures are... I'm not saying he's not doesn't exist, but let's posit a pension-like character or a novelist, and it would be so easy for like a group to come together and it's the Shakespeare theory.
Yeah.
Let's make a writer, and then we'll all kind of group write this stuff and lay in our secrets and or whatever they want, whatever they want to use that vehicle.
Or Fulcanelli, who is supposedly a amalgamation of other people.
Well, all of our seemingly these pop icons, like, I don't know if you guys listened to the Jason Horsley interview about Leonard Cohen, being a agent of some kind. My thoughts, well, he's from the future. That's what it is. There's a line in one of his famous songs, I'm Your Man, or the first lines, they sentenced me to 20 years of boredom.
For playing the electric violin.
Yeah. And I wonder about that line, and I'm like, well, then I think about being John Malkovich, and I think of those people sitting inside that person's head as he grows up, just watching, waiting until the time when they can take over, you know?
Wow.
Just from trying to change
that, that's also
from within.
That's also a Philip K. Dick plot in which book is it? But where they, one of the virtual reality things that people are engaged in on Mars is projecting into this world where they all control, like groups of people control individual people, and like
Palmer Eldritch.
Yeah, maybe that. Yeah. It's been a long time, but
Estee, you said something a second ago.
I was saying they sentenced me to 20 years of boredom for trying to change the system from within. That's
right.
The first little couplet there.
Right.
And first we take Manhattan, then we take Berlin. That's what that's what their song's called.
Yeah.
First we take Manhattan.
That's weird. And that goes into this whole CIA MK Ultra bit because, I mean, obviously Anne Diamond's whole thing is that he was an MK Ultra subject. And I think I had sort of a private like idea about MK Ultra and related to this whole time travel idea of, and what, when we say time travel, it's more of a, I don't think it's like, you step into a time machine and go back in time. It's more about like transfer of consciousness through, I think, occult prop means of some kind. I don't know. It's really, it's totally speculative and crazy, but I just had this thought of MK Ultra and what are they doing to these people in MK Ultra? They're like completely erasing their identities. They're basically creating these puppets, like people with like holes in their head. Like, and that's what Cronenberg, that's the very first Cronenberg movie called Stereo, which is about trepanation, people drilling holes in their heads for pleasure or like to trip or whatever, which people still do apparently. But like the idea of a hole in one's head and it being filled by some other sort of consciousness, and like MK Ultra as this sort of factory of like these types of basically creating vessels for like people. I think I'm going to lose my mind here. Vessels for people coming from the fucking future to, I'm just going to say it, to inhabit and influence the present.
Well, yeah, there's a lot that you just said that I think holds.
I think I'm going to be.
It would hold water if there weren't so many holes where the water was draining out. Not in your head, but in the heads of the.
I appreciate that.
No, you're right. There is a lot of erasing of personality. That the Batman shooter, like he seems prime.
And what was he was like a hype like. What was he studying? Like he was studying.
He was on a time travel. supposedly, I don't know. So he said they said he was researching that. Somebody knows it better than me, but yeah.
Yeah, he had gave some kind of talk or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Puppets.
Well, The one thing about Horsley's work I've really appreciated that he's brought to this discourse and kind of alternative perceptions, quote unquote, but even like the synchronicity flavor of that alternative perceptions is the idea of trauma and kind of trauma and personal work. What does he call it? Personal development. So shadow. It's kind of shadow work or like spirit, you know, so quote unquote, you know, pick a term. But I feel like that's really, you know, when I ask the question of what's the meaning, a lot of my synchronicities are all about my own person, my development, you know, my spiritual development, my understanding of who I am, you know, growing closer to some sort of divinity, if that's even possible, but, you know, healing, any number of things. And I think it's been really important, but the trauma, you know, going back to Infinite Jest, he wrote that, the genesis of that, I think, was his trip to a rehab center. Mm-hmm. And so he was undergoing a lot of personal trauma, and I think wrote from that experience when, I guess he channeled that book, but, you know, he strikes me as someone who was very maybe traumatized in a way, and sort of a fissure took place, an opening. What's the Leonard Cohen line? You know, the light got in because there was a crack, you know, and so. Well, I think that's an interesting part of this.
This is a little hardcore, but I think I mean, first of all, what did most people experience primarily as a result of 9/11? I mean, it was a trauma inducing event, but like, I can't help but wonder of what is the purpose of Guantanamo Bay? What is the purpose of Abu Ghraib? If they're not experiments in how to remove someone from their body, like literally like ejecting the person from them. And so the application of some of what the really sinister components to that and how that could be projected onto really large numbers of people makes me wonder. And I've also wondered this about – look, this is, I don't believe this. I wonder about the German people in the run up to the Nazis coming to party, coming to fruition. I know this is coalescing of so many different events at one time. And it's like, you know, I mean, I'm not into the whole dialogue related to it, but I wonder if like, this is like a, on a level is like a society being possessed and like mass possession events, by ejecting. I don't know. I've wondered about that too. And, yeah.
Well, the German, I mean, they were in poverty. Poverty is a really, pernicious thing. I mean, it really breaks people.
Yeah.
I mean, I've experienced it in my own life at times, you know, and it's just, it's really everything becomes about that the next injection of money to try to live, you know, and it really can break people. And so I think that anyhow, not to get off on the German thing, but this is actually a nice transition to the Rabbi Goldberg stuff. If you want me to real quickly lay it out,
yeah.
But it relates to this date of, so the whole thing is that, the date 420, mm-hmm. and this was on one of those talks that, one of the member hangouts, I was kind of just doing some research to prepare early on before I didn't quite know how they were going to unfold, but it was like, they think the second or third one, and I started studying 420, and you know, it's Hitler's birthday, 419 is that mass shooting in Columbine, 419 is Oklahoma City, or around these three dates are kind of all right there clustered together. But I started just trying to figure out what maybe behind that, and you know, using tarot, you guys know that tarot, the 36 pip cards, if you remove, so there's 40 pip cards, you remove the aces, you have 36 cards, and those can be laid out around the zodiac, and so each of those 36 cards represents dates, a 10-day period. And it's funny because Sean Fellow's site at the very bottom, it says 1 × 9 × 4, that's 36. And so I'm just wondering,
mm-hmm. Well, 36,
what's the importance of it?
Sorry to cut you off. But
no, just wondering, do you know what that is? Or
The importance of 36?
Yeah, according to Sean Fellow, like the 1 × 4 × 9.
Yeah, well, 1 × 4 × 9 are the dimensions of the monolith in 2001, which are actually given in 2010, the sequel. The physical dimensions of the actual object. But 36 is similar to 17 in that the first 36 digits added up all sum to 666.
Yeah.
And
the
that's
sun square.
Yeah, the sun square, exactly. Apollo. What was I gonna say? No, but I was my interest was very piqued by your talking about 420, that whole window. So, yeah, go ahead.
That whole window. So, you know, basically if you go to the tarot, and I don't know who developed this, if it's Golden Dawn or whoever, but if you look at that transition, first of all, on 420 is the transition from Aries to Taurus, astrologically. And in the tarot, the fourth card, the Emperor, is associated with Aries, and the fifth card, the Hierophant, is associated with Taurus. So there's this something about this 4 into 5 transition where there's kind of a spark of some kind of let's say evil. And it's the same with these the Pip cards. I believe it's the 4 of Wands completion, and then at 421, 420 to 421, there it goes to the 5 of Discs, worry. So again, there's a 4 to 5 right clustered around that date. But the thing about it, and this is a Rabbi Goldberg talk, his talks are like called the nature of evil. And in the Kabbalah, as you go from Chesed, which is 4 into the 5, which is Geburah, that's where evil somehow comes into existence. And there's, I'm not a Kabbalist. I'd be really curious to hear someone who could speak more eloquently on this. But in that video, he talks about how like these entities,
yeah,
somehow can come in on the number 5 on that 5th sphere, is like where the world of these demon entities come in.
I thought it's like kind of said about the influences of those entities was really, really right on. Like, that was interesting. And that, in general, I found him to have a really great tone. And I don't know, he's got an interesting voice.
Evil. And as 420 Hitler, all these big events around this, but with entities that are kind of fake. They're not human entities.
Yeah.
It's kind of like they're phony. And I love his tone too. I love it because it's like, may all beings, I come and I've studied Buddhism, sort of have an affinity for some of the Buddhist philosophy, but it's always about all beings be free from suffering. And it's very sort of compassionate and all encompassing philosophy. And in his talks, he always says, may all beings reach wisdom, or, you know, whatever it is. It's this very gentle, kind voice.
Yeah.
I love his energy too.
Yeah.
But that's kind of it. It's just laying out this idea of the 4 to the 5. And oh, the other one last point of this is that, in Alan's talk, did you guys see one of the early, synchronizes where it was the first one, What is Real? And then they had that song, and Alan got the association with C sharp and C kind of off. Did you guys watch that video by any chance?
I haven't seen it.
But yeah, anyhow.
Synchronized videos are like the one thing that I have not spent a ton of time in yet, but I'll go there eventually.
But the thing is, he uses Ezra Sanzer Bell's work, and Aries is red and the Hierophant is orange. And so it's that transition 4 to 5, red to orange. I just found it interesting in that context it came up again. And that was right around the time you mentioned to me, Dennis, you were kind of thinking about red and orange and those questions. But I just think it's this idea of the demon realm or whatever. It relates to this occult Hollywood, this, what did you call it earlier, Alex? I really like the phrase, fourth dimensional time lord. I don't know what any of this stuff, maybe they're good demons, bad demons, who knows, but.
Well, this kind of gets into the idea of the archons, from Gnostic lore, and that's also been coming up a lot. It was in that guy, the guy with the black goo, talking about the black goo. That was weird. But,
yes.
The German guy.
Yeah.
I watched that. Yes.
Yeah.
And the archons.
There's a lot of good material in that, but go ahead, Alex. Yeah.
Well, the archons figure pretty prominently in Sean's, work because he directly relates them to the bears. Because basically it's like, the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper, or these primary constellations in the night sky, right? They're called originally called Ursa Major and Ursa Minor, which was the Great Bear and the Little Bear. So they had tails. But he relates, it's kind of through language, the Greek word for bear is arctos, and this syllable arc, which keeps coming up, which even in that recent Always Record, with Znor, they were going on about the R syllable, A-R, and you get it in monarch, and archon, and arctos for bear, and then the syllable, U-R, is the other part of it, which is Ursine, which is the word for bear, and Ursa. And so in Sean's whole theory, like, the subliminal bears are the archons that are sort of out of our perception in a way, just right outside. And yeah, you nailed
it. Yeah, isn't that UR thing also? I remember one of the other examples he was using as related to Kubrick's name and Tubor, or to Egyptian town that was like a Liberian town that was like a stronghold against the incoming German forces. Like, and he's like talking about the juxtaposition of that, of the UR. Yeah, but anyways, continue. Yeah,
go ahead.
It's in like the third or fourth article, but I don't know. Yeah.
I'm trying to
It's a famous city in Mesopotamia, which is kind of the land between two rivers, the origin of, when I went to school, it was that's where we came from, the first civilization, Ur.
It's a city
in Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
Ur, yes. And that's the beginning.
In Iraq.
That's the beginning of civilization, right?
Sumer, so that you got the Sitchin stuff there, but yeah, Mesopotamia, Sumer. Anyhow, go ahead. Modern day Iraq. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
The Bush family, you know, that they claim he was taken over and they were sent to Iraq to like. I find it funny. ISIS is destroying a bunch of artifacts there now, and it's like, what are they trying to cover up?
Yeah.
But anyhow,
That's scary.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, that subplot of one of the Da Vinci Demons shows was the possession of all these artifacts and the what could be done with those artifacts. But, yeah, I don't know. But continue. Sorry, deep aside.
Well, I was just looking through Sean's, one of his opening chapters talking about all this, and he's got the Arctos equals arch, and then with the rainbow, because it's 42 degrees is the angle at which the rainbow is visible, and the rainbow is an arc. And then the arc is also archer, like as in a bowman, as in David Bowman. So there's all these like associations.
Sagittarius is the art card that's associated with Sagittarius, and art has the rainbow in it. Temperance has a rainbow association. Anyhow, just and, going.
Yeah. So I was trying to. Sorry. Oh, and he just like he has a little thing here about Anthony Burgess, who wrote Clockwork Orange. Of course, he has the Ur in his name, and he wrote A Clockwork Orange, and then his next book was a book called Honey for the Bears. Which came out in 1963, I guess.
I had always heard that Stanley Kubrick told Anthony Burgess about his conversations with RCC. He told Anthony Burgess about the idea for the book A Clockwork Orange based on his conversations that him and Arthur C. Clarke had had with ex-Nazi scientists and these actual experiments that they had been doing. So
I had not heard that. That's very interesting. Believe it.
And that would have been after Leonard Cohen. You know, he was in the early MK Ultra program in the 50s, if Anne Diamond is to be believed. And so it very well have been some of those experiments that the idea for Clockwork Orange, you know, if they were keyed into that whole experiment network that was based on some of the Nazi research. Now, yeah, that's total conjecture, but you think of Leonard Cohen as being Alex, you know?
Yeah.
Well, one of many. And it's Monarch programming. That's the whole idea, or that's what people call it, Monarch programming that he's subjected to, which is...
The main actor in Zero Theorem's name is Cohen, and the guy is constantly getting his name wrong and calling him Quinn, or this other boss guy is getting it, and he's like constantly correcting him that it's Cohen, not Quinn. I don't know what that.
It's interesting.
But Cohen.
I heard Quinn. I don't know. Never mind.
not to distract, I know there's a sort of good flow here, but this space junk event, like obviously another event that that probably is only rich in its symbology, perhaps not in its the actual event, but like
it's even real.
It's even real, exactly. I don't know. But yeah, the WT1190F, it's as a reverse 9/11 with the WTF in it, which is hilarious. I don't know. But, yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah. I don't know. But like, I don't know. This is the thing. Like, I that's like the number that I am like constantly feel like I'm being presented with is the inverse of 9/11 being the 119. So I've been looking for an example of that occurring as a sort of a partner to the events of 9/11, but I don't know. Yeah, it's, I wonder if some of these events purely are about projecting numbers and letters rather than the actual event being a real occurrence. Like, yeah, I mean.
100%, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in 119 is related to Sean's work because of it's paired with the number 118, because 118 plus 119 equals 237.
So,
I don't know what to say about that, but that's just, there's all these like numbers that reappear in these different like roles. Like I think at some one time Sean called like referenced it to like a chessboard, like the pieces on the chessboard are like different numbers that are being used, to some purpose.
Yeah.
Like, but they're paired. You know, like you got two rooks, and you have an 8 and 119, and they're like, they reference each other. I'm sort of losing my train of thought. I need to take another drink of coffee.
Well, the idea of, are you gonna go? You want to launch into something, Dennis? Here, or,
I'm also in that sort of loopy zone. I've been, I had this big deadline to finish some work. I had like been up so late every night the last couple nights, but loopy's good sometimes. So I'm all good. But go ahead, yeah. Jay. Sorry.
I was just gonna say the idea of pairing numbers. I find it really fascinating. Going back to tarot, you know, there's a lot of ways to look at the major arcana. It's 21. Numbers, but 22 cards, and you can line them up. Each of the numbered cards has an analog, like a 21 can be added to 0, and then you get 21. But basically, all the major arcana can be added together, and they all have a pair such that the sum of the two equal 21. And it's just one way to analyze the major arcana. I just kind of what you were saying there, Alex, that numbers kind of have a necessary pair. Mm-hmm. That goes with them. I just was thinking of tarot in that context.
And 21.
And I just saw the. Go ahead.
Well, just real quick, 21 is half of 42. So.
Yeah.
It's half of 42. Uh-huh. I saw on the 42 minutes, the last one of the recent ones, you said that was 21 minutes. I don't know if you guys caught that. I was like, is that a mistake? Is that intentional? But the card for today, for this date that we're in right now, is actually the five of cups, which is disappointment, and that's you know, the five is associated with Gebra, that realm where the sort of demons come in. So maybe that has something to do with the willies, is that what we that are just seem to be in the air. But anyhow, this is some fascinating stuff, guys. Yeah, I mean, I come to this from more of a perspective of like truth, you know, what is real, you know, I mean, it seems like as a human being, as a conscious being, that seems to be a relevant question, you know, the search for reality, my personal life, but also that necessarily means in the world around me that I inhabit. And so, you know, I just really like the discussion, and something I'll mention, Dennis, I wanted to raise was this relationship between so-called conspiracy and synchronicity and how there's interplay, but there's also clearly separation, you know, I mean, just because, for instance, you know, or let's say this, a synchronicity isn't going to be the best evidence in like a court of law to indict someone or to convict someone for a criminal conspiracy. But, you know, so it's not always the best evidence in that way to talk about conspiracy. But then there are these weird sort of, like Lavenda says, these sinister forces. And the other thing, oh, this is just one other thing here. Vincent Boog Lugosi, the guy that was the, who wrote the book about the Manson murders. He and Peter Lavenda's book's all about Manson and the sinks around that as part of these sinister forces. But he died also on June 6th, the same day as Kubrick. I just read this list, so it was fresh in my mind, but that's a name, another name that jumped out at me was Vincent Bugliosi.
Yeah. Just to
so it's kind of another footprint of those sinister forces.
He said same day as Kubrick. Kubrick did, he died on March 7th.
Oh, sorry, as young and, yeah, young. And then the president. The,
right.
RFK.
Right.
Yeah.
Got it.
Sorry about that.
No, that's fine. Yeah, I didn't realize that. That's interesting. He died this year, too. Interesting.
And then the Manson RFK, that's a whole nother, you know, discussion. I think David Plates covered that quite extensively on Always Record.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So anyhow, you know, what is this work for me? I mean, if I'm going to be a conspiracist, let's say, I mean, I do read so-called conspiracy material. I do find it edifying and useful to kind of situate myself in this reality. I don't buy it all, but I just like hearing a different discourse.
Yeah, sure.
Maybe to counter some of the mainstream corporate discourses. And synchronicity obviously is very important. Just I find it to be useful to identify them and sort of from an intuition perspective, like to make decisions, kind of like you're talking about, Alex. But I think there's a thread there that it's kind of the search for truth or to, you know, find, navigate my reality. There's a relationship between those two worlds beyond synchronicity being evidence for conspiracy. You know, they come from a similar motivation, I find, which is this kind of search for reality, maybe.
Indeed.
And I just wanted to raise that because I feel like often in the discussion, there's kind of a they're pitted against each other in a way.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
people
yeah.
kind of get tense about it. And I just, you know, I think it's important to just address it and kind of map it out a little bit that they don't have to be enemies, you know.
Yeah,
they can be separate.
I know. I've been trying to. It's interesting that you bring that up because just the last 2 days, I watched that Jake Kotze video like numerous times, and I really began to sort of reevaluate for myself where I'm sitting on some of that. And I don't know. I don't know if I have any definitive conclusion about it, but yeah, I mean, because I maybe I'm wrongfully characterizing some of his works, but I feel like he's just saying this is the coalescing nature of it, and there is no I don't know where the role of a sinister force exists in Jake's work, so
or his world.
I don't know. I don't have enough of a sense of it. So, but like, but yeah, I don't know. I feel like. I don't know. I see it. I don't know. I wonder if the whole construct, yes, I don't know what the mechanism for tunneling into and moving it is, but it feels like it's there. And I don't really know what more to add. I don't know. But yeah, I think it's extremely pertinent what you said. I wish I had better answers. But who doesn't? So.
What you said resonated with me because about trying to figure out what is real, because it seems to me that we live in an increasingly irreal world or unreal. Like, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I look at the TV, I look at the news that's coming out of the mainstream, and I think it's all bullshit. Like, if it's on TV, I immediately am suspicious.
Yeah.
Of what it is. And all these shootings that are happening. There's always, of course, these dozens of people on YouTube talking about it being a false flag or whatever. Which seems, I mean, it is, I think partly it is. But like, there's also this dialectic where they know that everybody's going to go on YouTube and start ranting about it so that that can use that to like discredit the idea of conspiracy. And,
I think what we were discussing earlier about a level of influence that's not simply just crisis actors, like this whole filling in is like, I think I'm more on that level. Like I spend more time thinking about that than actual like A, B, C conspiracy related to how things are done. I do think that they happen. I think it totally happens. Like, I mean, I think Sandy Hook is like, I don't know how you can look at the Sandy Hook material and not think that there's like very direct levels of it occurring.
And it seems like that's gotten just been intensified ever since 9/11. But then as this happens, I don't know if either of you are familiar with this guy, Miles Mathis.
Listening to this broadcast from Sync Book Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune into our other Sync Book Radio programs, including 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leitz Mathemagical Radio Hour, Pentimental, Synchronize, Sync Quick News, as well as our most recent editions, Fine Just Fine and Hypnosis. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.